Welcome to PCMC. Ooh, it's Halloween 2023. This is the final chapter of Halloween 2023. What a journey we've taken as we've gone through slashix. We've talked about Halloween from 1978, the original Friday the 13th, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and I'm here today to talk about A Nightmare on Elm Street with my good friend Peter. Last voyage of the Demeter, Marsh.
Yes. What's up, man? How you doing?
I'm actually doing good. You know, I am a big fan of this season. Spooky season is what I live for. It's basically a 2-month film festival that I curate for myself, where I watch just a ton of horror. Like, I know you and Danny for the LasherCast, you kind of consume horror all the time. I like save it like from September 1st to October 31st. It's like I get it all out of the way, and then I watch period dramas for the rest of the year. No, I watch a lot of sci-fi bullshit.
Oh, sci-fi bullshit's great. I love that too. So is it kind of like on your plate? You eat all the vegetables and stuff first, and then you put all the horror stuff on the side, and that's how you consume it, how you consume your media?
Well, it's like, in a way, yeah. Like, well, I love everything I consume. I never like watch something that I don't want to, you know. But like, yeah. This week I watched Possessor and Infinity Pool, two movies by Brandon Cronenberg.
Right.
And I was like, and I was I wrote you my master's thesis on David Cronenberg, so like I was like big into Cronenberg. So yeah. I was like, okay, I'm gonna wait for October to watch them, and because I know they're gonna be. Have you seen those movies?
I've seen Possessor. I haven't seen Infinity Pool.
Infinity Pool, I think, is even... It's not as good a movie, but it's more depressing.
Mm-hmm.
It more like is you'll come away from it feeling like, ugh. Yep.
Like, that's pretty bad considering how much of a downer Possessor is, too.
Yeah, yeah. Possessor's a better high concept, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But what do you do? How do you celebrate this time of year? Do you have different consumption of media?
Well, it's funny because there's so much stuff out right now, right? You know, obviously for different film studios, they're like, okay, we got to put out all of our Halloween stuff. We got to put all our scary stuff out right now. So you have a whole bunch of movies that are in the theaters just right now. There's like streaming stuff. You know, our show is called The LasherCast, and that's named after the Lasser Glass, which is the mirror that's in Mike Flanagan's movie Oculus, right? Mm-hmm. And we started out as like a Mike Flanagan channel, and he has a show that's out right now called Fall of the House of Usher, which is on Netflix.
Okay, how is that?
It's good. It's weird because I've only watched one episode so far, and it feels like he's trying to do Succession. And it's weird for like Mike Flanagan to do Succession.
Right, it seemed like a real different... Because, like, I've read the story, and I saw the original film with Vincent Price, and it seems like he's kind of doing, like, what he did with Haunting of Hill House. Like, mm-hmm. taking a short story and making a series out of it and just putting a bunch of other shit into it. Because mm-hmm. this is, like, an Edgar Allan Poe, like, hodgepodge of bullshit.
Yes, that's one thing that's really interesting about Mike Flanagan is that, like, you know, he did Midnight Club, which was basically, you know, there's a book by Christopher Pike called Midnight Club. And the concept is it's a bunch of kids that tell stories to each other because they're all in this house where essentially they're going to die of cancer, right? And they basically added a lot to it. They took different Christopher Pike stories and made those be the stories the kids were telling. And then he also did Haunting of Bly Manor, which is like, I'm trying to think what the author is, Henry James, right? And that's like it's like a story, the turning of the screw. That's like the main plot, but then they stuck a bunch of other Henry James stories in there too.
Yeah. I haven't seen I like him. I like Dr. Sleep. I like his stuff. I've actually never seen Oculus,
but it's pretty good. Have you ever seen Hush?
No.
It's like a home invasion movie, and his wife is the main character, and she's deaf.
Okay, I have not seen it, but now I know what you're talking about. He does a lot of shit with Netflix.
He absolutely does, but his Netflix contract just ended, so he's going to start doing stuff with Prime now.
Isn't he supposed to be doing like a Dark Tower series?
Oh yes.
Is that really happen though? I've lost hope with that.
Yeah, probably rightfully so. I don't know what's happened. That it's not been talked about since all the strikes have gone on.
Yeah. Well, this morning I rewatched A Nightmare on Elm Street from 1984, and goddamn, is it a good movie? Like, I've seen this movie so many times in so many different contexts, and the context that we're sort of looking at it today is in the slasher craze. And like, you know, no offense to Sean S. Cunningham, but like, people always compare Freddy and Jason. If you just took Friday the 13th part one and the Nightmare on Elm Street part one, I mean, one's fucking Citizen Kane and the other's like Clerks, you know, like,
yes.
Just like just the everything about this movie is like, the acting is amazing, the writing is amazing, the production design is amazing, the music's amazing, the sound effects are amazing. It's like such a cut above all that other stuff.
Yes.
I just honestly like love it.
Yeah. You know what's funny, Mike, is that I don't know if I've ever sat down and watched it from beginning to end until yesterday.
Really?
Yeah. This happens a lot to me where just growing up and having like HBO on my TV, I would always just get snippets of movies and I'd usually see like the end first, then the middle. And I could like kind of put a movie together like a Frankenstein monster, but I don't think I've ever sat down and watched this straight through.
Wow. So how was that experience?
It was great. I mean, I ended up watching the documentary Never Sleep Again, which was about this. And, you know, we covered Wes Craven on the LasterCast a couple of months ago. We covered about a bunch of his films that weren't Scream or Nightmare on Elm Street. And I just really, really appreciated him after watching this movie and watching that documentary.
He's a wild guy because he grew up in a very strict religion where he did not watch any films until he was an adult, which is crazy because it's like we all are consuming movies and media all the time. And he couldn't. He was not allowed. And then, like, I think he became a teacher. He, like, he wasn't that young even when he started working. Like, he already had, like, a family and a career. And then, like, the first thing he makes is Last House on the Left, which is, like, brutal movie. And then you've got this and, you know, and, of his non-Scream, non-Nightmare stuff, what do you think's the best?
I haven't seen all of it. We just watched like Shocker. We watched The People Under the Stairs. The People Under the Stairs is actually Danny's favorite. For that question, he loves The People Under the Stairs a lot. Red Eye is even kind of good for what it is, I think. I don't know. I Scream is my favorite horror franchise. So that's kind of my go-to is the first Scream. But I like the original Hills Have Eyes. I'm actually a huge fan of the Hills Have Eyes remake too.
Yeah. You're not alone with that. It's a very good remake.
Yeah. I mean, he had nothing to do with that, but, you know, I appreciate that. And it's weird. Like you were just saying before how he, you know, didn't start making movies until later in life. He was like 30 years old when he got into filmmaking.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
So you're around the same age as me, right?
I'm 41.
I just turned 40. So, What's your like history with Freddy?
Okay,
growing up in the 80s.
Yeah. You know, like I said, I watched a lot of these movies on HBO, and it's usually just pieces of them. And I think that I probably watched Dream Warriors the most out of all of them.
Sure, of course.
I usually would see a lot of the later sequels, and you know, I watched, as far as like going to see a Freddy movie in the theater, I watched Freddy versus Jason.
Yeah.
And then I haven't seen the remake. I think that's the only fucking one I've seen in the theaters, Freddy versus Jason.
Wow. I like the remake, by the way. A lot of people hate it. I did not mind it at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think you're right. Like, because of our age, we just couldn't. Like, we were like, what, 12 when Freddy's Dead came out or New Nightmare? Like, I mean, maybe we could have seen a New Nightmare, but. Right, Freddy vs. Jason is the only one I saw in the theater. But this was like a VHS classic. Like, I have an older brother. He watched them all. This was something you'd watch at sleepovers. I had Freddy doll when you'd pull the string. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, my mother had no problems buying that for me. Like, I had Freddy gloves. I had Freddy for Halloween when I was, like, 8 or something crazy. Like, Freddy is, like, our Dracula.
Yes.
Like, Freddy is... He's above all these other guys. And it's funny, like, what we've been doing this month with these episodes is like looking at these movies as singular pieces outside of the context of their franchises.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of, I forgot that there's a lot of Christian imagery in this movie, like with crucifixes and stuff.
And
that to me again makes me feel like very like he's like Dracula.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, he kind of preys on young innocent girls, and he kind of comes after them when they're in their nightgowns and stuff. Yeah. Or they're, you know, like they're in bed, and that's kind of the imagery of like the Bela Lugosi Dracula is like he comes in through the window. You know, Freddy just is already in there with you in your dreams. But that's interesting that you make that comparison, because usually when people talk about Freddy, they call him the boogeyman, you know?
Yeah. I think another thing that's refreshing when you watch the original movie is the image of Freddy. First of all, like Freddy, as the series goes on, it's like he's the protagonist you're rooting for. And he's fully lit. You could totally see him. In this first movie, you can't get a really good look at him for a while. He's shrouded in darkness, and he's also not he's not Bugs Bunny. He's not Groucho Marx, like quip, quip, quip. He's not wearing sunglasses on the beach going like, surf 10, bitch. Like, like, you know, whatever the fuck. Like, he's a monstrous guy who has a regular name, Freddy, but it's not like, it's so interesting that he became like someone who had his own TV show and like, you know, bubblegum and bullshit. Like, it's kind of crazy.
Yeah, he's like one of those iconic horror monsters that you just see them so often, and they get parodied in things too, and they just sort of lose their edge, right? Like the Xenomorph is like terrifying, but you see like the Xenomorph in like kids' cartoons and stuff, right?
Yeah.
And it's the same thing with Freddy. Like, just over time, he's just gotten diluted. Like, that first movie, I liked your idea of watching this and making it like you had it with a fresh set of eyes. You're not thinking about the sequels. I think that this would have been really scary to see in the theater.
I mean, if you had, if you were walking in and you didn't know anything about it, I think it would be terrifying. It's got a couple of really good jump scares.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like jump scares are, I think, a touchy topic, because some people think that they're very cheap. Some people don't. Some people love them. Some people hate them. I think that jump scares are a tool, and it's fine to use tools. Mm-hmm. But I think in this film, they're more than just a jump scare. Like, they help move the plot forward. They're not just, ooh, jump, and you're scared. Like, probably the two biggest ones in this movie are when he comes out of the mirror.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Her, which yes. Is yes.
Something you would never be able to guess if you didn't know it. Like, it's just like, and when she brings him out of the dream and he comes up from behind her, that still gets me, even though I know it's coming.
That's the best one.
Any second now, it's gonna be any second now.
That is the best one. I love that one. You know, it's funny, right? Because when you watch the documentary, Never Sleep Again, they talk about how when they were doing the dailies for the movie, the editor had a hard time discerning, like, what was the nightmare footage and what was the real life footage. And that's what's really cool about this. Even in this first movie, they really play that up, where it's like, am I having a dream? Is this reality? And so, like, you know, obviously there's the rules of the real world, and then there's the rules of the nightmare world.
Right.
And since you can't tell sometimes which one you're in, he could just fucking pop up anywhere.
Right, right, right. And this movie is, and I credit Wes Craven for this, this movie gets surrealism so much better than a lot of the sequels that came. Like, later on, there was a lot of money put into it, so there's a lot of like elaborate dream sequences, like we're in a comic book, or like we're, you know, like we're at the beach, or we're on a talk show, like crazy shit like that. In this, it's like you're in your house, you're in your school, you're in familiar places, and there's a lot of darkness. There's a lot of weird imagery. There's things that bleed from one place to another.
Mm-hmm.
Like at the end, when she's in the dream and she pulls him out, she wakes up on her bed and you see she's got like the rose bushes. and then she throws them, and then the shot zooms out. So obviously there was like a someone on the film crew who pulls it out of the shot, but I didn't notice that until I was really looking at it. And it's like, oh shit, she has something physically with her. And then in the next image, it's gone.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like the tooth in the window, like when Tina dies, which is one of the best kills in horror movies ever.
Yes.
When she dies, before she dies, there's like a crack on her window, and she looks, and there's a tooth, a human tooth in the window. And it's so surreal.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fantastic. The imagery in this movie, you know, it starts to blend together through all the different sequels. Like, oh, does this happen in this third one? Does this happen in the fourth one? But there's certain images in this movie that are just iconic images, right? And one of my favorite ones is when Freddy is coming through the wall, right above Nancy. And what I love about the documentary I watched is that this movie only cost like a million, $1.1 million,
yeah,
right? And they were like super cheap and practical with how they made these effects. Like that effect of him coming through the wall is just him pushing up against spandex.
Yeah,
like is Robert Englund just pushing up against spandex on the wall,
right?
And that kill that you just mentioned, Tina's kill, which is this crazy incredible iconic kill, they did this thing where they fucking made a set that could like rotate. And so like the actress that played her, she was just talking about how like she had crazy vertigo, like being on that set, like she didn't know which was up and which was down. And then they use that same set when Johnny Depp gets killed, and the
which blood is another amazing kill.
Exactly. The imagery in this is like so iconic, and there's things in the future sequels that, you know, people always reference, right? Like you had, I gotta look them up while we're talking, but there's this one fucking amazing FX artist that comes in later in the series and does some of the special effects. And then you had like other directors that are kind of visual directors, like Rennie Harlan. Yeah. Oh shit, we're not supposed to be talking about different films in the series, right?
Right. It's hard not to, right?
Sorry. But like, just this first movie alone, like what you said when you were doing your Halloween episode, that if they had just made this a movie and like there was no other sequels, this would be like referenced a lot because
it would be like a classic movie.
Exactly.
Not just a classic horror movie. Like people would, yeah, because it's so good. What of all the, I should say, another thing that strikes me is, you know, interesting watching it again. Something that I don't think the other films do at all is there's a lot of times in this film where we see the outside of a dream. We see someone who's sleeping having a dream, like Tina's death, right? We don't see him crawling with her. We just see her like flipping around. Or same thing with what's his name? With Johnny Depp.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, you don't see Freddy in that sequence at all.
Yeah.
And you don't really see when Tina's boyfriend gets killed either. You don't see what's going on.
Right.
He's murdered either.
Yeah, we're watching. Yeah. That's a really weird scene because that's like a very surreal scene because she tells her boyfriend, okay, I want you to watch me while I sleep. And then we cut and they're outside and it's like foggy. And she goes, are you still there? And he comes out from behind a tree and he's like, yeah. Which is crazy because it's a visual representation of him watching her sleep. And then like across the street is the police station and she can like look down into the cell and then like 1000, he like walks through the bars.
Yeah.
That's a good effect.
Yes.
And she's in her dream watching him be killed.
Yeah. Okay.
It's such a weird level.
Wes Craven, he's clearly like a very talented guy and like knows how to make like effective imagery and to really build up that tension.
Yeah.
Right. And he's the one that came up with the one, two, Freddy's coming for you, right? And then when he got the composer, just another way that they kind of cut corners and to make things cheaper is that the composer, instead of having a whole orchestra, he just essentially made all the music at his house, right?
Yeah.
And that whole the theme that's so great in this movie, the doon 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 doon, right? That's kind of the composer took that one, two, Freddy's coming for you. Yeah. And just like amped it up and added more to it.
Yeah, it's the sound and the music are great. The way it begins, where you just hear like the high pitched note, and we see a frame within a frame of Freddy making his glove. And when you watch it again, you see something that you didn't realize before. In this movie, Freddy is signaled or telegraphed by the sound of his claws on metal a lot. It happens a lot. Like, you just hear the squeak of his nails, and it's almost like Jaws, like when the shark is represented by John Williams' music. Like, you hear that squeak, and you're like, oh, shit, Freddy's around.
Yeah. That's so funny that you compare it to Jaws, like a Spielberg movie, because the actual noise of his claws kind of reminded me of, like, the Velociraptor noise that they would make.
Yes, yeah. Super high-pitched.
Yeah.
And there's great imagery. Tina in the body bag almost kind of looks like a nun, or like a, at one point she's standing on like snakes, which I think is a Christian image. I'm not sure.
Sure.
Something like that. And it's just, and that image appears a few times, like the Tina coming to her when she falls asleep at school. That's a great scene because there's a kid in the front of class doing a presentation. But then when it turns into a dream, everybody's still there, but they're all, the kids like whispering now.
Mm-hmm,
and everybody's acting sort of slow and disaffected. And it's so weird to see everyone else acting like they're in a dream.
Mm-hmm.
The dream work is so, so good in this movie. It's really incredible.
Yeah. I mean, the music and the sound design help with Craven's imagery, right?
Yeah.
Because like the music just has this sort of, like, I'm trying to think of how to explain it. Like, it's almost like a fairy tale, the actual like theme of the movie.
Yes.
It's very kind of sweet and innocent sounding. And then you have sort of like John Carpenter kind of fast beat stuff when like Freddy's chasing people around.
Yes.
But for the most part, it does have that feeling of a dream. The music itself gives you that dream kind of feeling. It almost sounds like wind chimes or something. And then, obviously the sound design is really great because, like, you know, you have Freddy's claws. There's multiple scenes that are like in like a boiler room setting, and there's always like that kind of echo to Freddy's voice.
Yeah.
And, you know, that feeling that you're like trapped in another realm. You mentioned that one sequence where Tina's in the body bag. And it's funny because we covered Shudder's 101 scariest horror movie moments of all time. And they made a point to not, like, just do a whole bunch of scenes from different franchises. Like, they didn't do like five different Freddy moments and six different Jason moments. They only did like one per franchise. And for Nightmare on Elm Street, they did that sequence where she's in the body bag in the school.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's funny because, like, would you have put that as the scariest scene in this movie?
That's such an interesting question.
Yeah.
I joined you guys for one of your episodes covering it, and we talked about how we love the documentary, but some of the choices were interesting choices, like putting an episode from Twin Peaks in it.
Right.
It's funny. I know. I mean, it, to me, it's one of the most indelible images. But honestly, if you said you had to pick one, it would be Freddy with his arms extended out, which again is like, if that's the bad guy, how do you have any chance? Like, if he could be anywhere. That's the thing. Like, I love what you just said about it being a fairy tale, because it feels like a fairy tale, right? But, like, what's the point of fairy tales? It's to teach children that the world is not safe, to be cautious. But in fairy tales, it's like, listen, don't leave home. Don't go into the woods, because you can't be protected by your parents in the woods. But this is like, the point of this is your parents cannot protect you no matter what. And you have to sleep. And so it's not the woods, it's your sleep. And it's not on the beach. It's not a comic book. It's all places that you already live. Your bedroom, your school, stuff like that. So it's so interesting because it's like
universal.
It's universal, but if you're going with the fairy tale thing, it's like there's no lesson to be learned almost. Like there's like, you're basically fucked. There's nothing you can do. Like, you can't say, okay, you can't say just stay awake, because you can't. And what do the, and I love, by the way, I love the performances by all the actors who play the parents, because they're all shitty assholes. Like, Johnny Depp's dad is such an asshole. And of course, her parents are assholes. And right. That's, like, they're all complicit in this vigilante justice.
Yes. That's one of the most interesting things about this movie and essentially this whole franchise, yeah. too, is the idea that, like, the parents created this monster and the kids yeah. have to suffer the sins of the parents, right?
Right.
Now, I never saw this movie, but I'm betting you did. Did you see It Follows?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
I did an episode on it.
Okay. So, like, for It Follows, I've never seen it, but I've heard a shit ton about it. I've seen some clips from it and stuff. And it kind of sounds like it is kind of like a morality tale in the sense of, like, they're passing around this creature like an STD. Like, if you have sex, you're going to give this creature to someone else, right? And that's
I never saw it really as an STD thing, but I think it's about, like, the social contract. Like, you can get away from this villain by giving it to someone else. And do you do that?
Right. Well, and so with this, what I thought was very interesting about this was that Freddy, like, if he basically is focused on you, essentially, if you go to sleep, he's going to kill you.
Yeah.
Like, it's just guaranteed, okay, Freddy has picked you out and he's going to kill you, so you can't go to sleep. I mean, that's the whole genesis of this movie. Like, Wes Craven, you know, he had these ideas for a while. He had read about these, like, Hmong refugees, right, mm-hmm. who had fled their home country, and they had experienced, like, genocide. They'd seen such traumatic things that they would have these incredibly intense nightmares. And so they didn't want to sleep because the nightmares were so horrible. And then some of them did actually die when they were asleep.
Yeah.
Right. Now, the other story about Freddy, you probably know the other story of the inspiration, yes. right? With the kid.
Well, I remember a story Wes Craven said when he was a kid, he saw a man dressed like Freddy outside his window who, like, basically kind of fucked with him, like, stood there and, like, looked at him and scared the shit out of him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he had Freddy's hat.
Yeah.
And when Wes Craven was designing the Freddy character, the stripes on his sweater, apparently, like, he had read somewhere that those two colors are very unnerving for people to look at when you combine those two particular colors. Yeah. But you know what, Mike? That's not even the thing I was referencing. The story I'm talking about is he read an article about, I think it was a kid in, like, Los Angeles. He was, like, of Asian descent. And he kept telling his parents, I can't go to sleep. I can't go to sleep. If I do, this thing's going to get me. And he eventually did fall asleep in his living room. His parents took him up into his bedroom. And then when he was asleep in his bedroom, he did die.
Yeah, wow.
And the craziness is they investigated his room. They found all the sleeping pills they had been giving him because he had insomnia. Yeah. He hadn't taken them. And then they also found a coffee pot in his room, and it had been connected by an extension cord out of the bedroom.
Which is what we see in this film. Nancy's has a coffee pot in her bedroom. But that's the crazy thing too, right? Because it's like there's no way out of it. You know, at one point she says, I've been up for 7 days, but I looked up the Guinness World Record and 11 is the world record. So like she's only 4 days away from dying, right? Because you have to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Roger Rabbit tells us, Roger Rabbit's in this movie.
Wait, what?
Yeah, Charles Fleischer, who's the voice of Roger Rabbit, plays the doctor at the sleep clinic.
Okay. I knew he looked familiar. I didn't realize that's the guy that, like, literally would be Roger Rabbit.
Yeah.
That's crazy. You know, like, going back to your point that you made about how, like, you know, you can't escape him and it's so scary. And then it's also kind of like this universal thing. I think that's what's so interesting is he almost seems like some kind of virus or something that you get. Like, once you're kind of infected with Freddy, he's going to get you in your sleep and you're going to die. Yeah.
And it's not he uses terror, I think, to power himself up, right? Because it doesn't sound like anyone has one dream and they're dead. Like, you have a Freddy dream and you wake up and you talk about it with your friends. Like, you know what I mean? It seems like you have two or three Freddy dreams and then the third or fourth is when he kills you.
Yeah, exactly. He, like, savors it and stuff. And, you know, they go into more detail about that in the sequels, which we're not going to talk about. But I think that, mm-hmm. like, in this first movie, because they don't elaborate on that, it makes it scarier. And yeah, I also wanted to make one point too. I didn't know if we were ever going to talk about like more about the behind the scenes stuff, but this movie was made by New Line Cinema, right? And Wes Craven like shopped this movie around to all different major studios and nobody wanted it.
Right.
Then he found Bob Shea, who's the head of New Line Cinema, and they just had like a real small office. Bob Shea was interested, and the reason why he was interested in Nightmare on Elm Street is because of what you said, which is like everyone needs to sleep.
Yeah.
So he felt like he wanted to make a horror movie that was like universal, where it applies to everybody. So
other studios stupidly would be like pass on the movie because they'd be like, well, how can it be scary if you know it's a dream? Which is such a stupid thing to say.
Right.
Because it's like, well, I know it's a film as well, but like, of course, if the thing that's registered on screen is frightening, it's going to be frightening. And also, he kills you in the dream. It's not like it's a dream and you wake up. Like, you die in the dream.
Yes, yes. I mean, they. I'm sure there were many executives kicking themselves for not picking up this movie because it was a tremendous hit when it came out. And for New Line, one of their nicknames was the house that Freddie built.
Yeah.
Because it was such a big hit for them, you know?
Bob Shea's sister is the... Lynn Shea is the teacher.
Yes, yes.
Probably her biggest role, though, is as the creepy... landlord in the movie Kingpin.
Yes.
I bought you some alcohol. I know you like gin, so I got you some gin.
Right. Well, so isn't she like a creepy old lady in Something About Mary too, or is that a different lady?
Yes, same directors.
Oh, the Farrelly brothers. Right?
Yeah.
So you say that her biggest role is that, but I actually think her biggest role is in Insidious.
That's true.
Yeah.
Let's talk about trying to tie in everything that I've talked about this month. I want to talk about Suburbia because Suburbia is such a big theme, I think, in all slasher films. You know, like the suburbs are a consciously made phenomenon. You know, like we had you wanted to after World War II, you wanted people to have really good middle class lives. You wanted them to buy cars and buy gas. So you said, you know what? Instead of working where you live, which would always be the intuitive thing that everyone always did throughout time, they were like, you don't have to work where you live. You can work somewhere and then live somewhere really nice and hidden away and away from all the elements that we, you know, you may think are bad elements, you know, whatever that is racially or anything like that. And you can have like, you know, the American dream, it changes, but the American dream, at least in the beginning, was land, right? Manifest destiny. So we'll give you a lawn, that's your little land, and you get your little house and you have your little car and you could have a picket fence, middle class life. And this is big in like things like Blue Velvet. Like, I know you like David Lynch films. My brother brought up a good point that I had never thought about, which was in the original Halloween, when Laurie Strode is out on the street running from Michael, she goes up to different houses and bangs on the doors and nobody lets her in, which is kind of like the urban
Kitty Genovese.
Kitty Genovese. If you don't know, Kitty Genovese is, I say urban legend because she was a real person, but a lot of what we know about the story is not true. But the idea of Kitty Genovese was she was living in an apartment building, and she was killed, I think, in the corridor behind it. So everyone heard her, but nobody helped her. And yellow journalist at the time that it happened, like, made a lot of big headlines out of like, look what the urban world is doing to us. Look at living together is doing to us. It's making us desensitized. No one helped this woman. That's actually bullshit. Three people called the cops, but the legend persists. But that's what's happening with Laurie Strode. Like, nobody's letting her in. And in this, again, like, the grown-ups, the parents of all the victims, they are the reason this is all happening. What do you think about Wes Craven's sort of vision of Suburbia?
That is a really, really great question. I think that's... When Wes Craven was making Freddy, he said this in the documentary too, that he just wanted to make like this really despicable character. He had all these different kind of elements that we already talked about, But he was saying the fact that he made a character that was a child molester and a child murderer, right, that he just made this like really horrible character. Mm-hmm. And it makes sense that the parents would murder Freddy and have like vigilante justice based upon the horrible things that he did. But so I think that like when you think about the parents, because you were talking about how like awful the parents are.
Yeah.
I think that them getting vigilante justice on like a child killer and like a child molester, that's not as bad as like them sort of like lying and keeping it from their kids and kind of treating their kids like, especially when the kids start saying like, oh, there's a guy named Fred Krueger, and they start to kind of tell details about Freddy. Like the parents don't acknowledge it really. They always kind of like, you know, we use the term gaslighting. They like gaslight their kids a lot in this movie, right? They're like, oh, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. You need to get some sleep, right? So I think that's the main sin of the parents, is sort of like they're not telling their kids about their dark secret, so their dark secret is killing their kids, literally.
Right.
And so
they're burying their dark secret and just pretending it's not there.
Right, right. I mean, like one of the images that you see, I think at least twice in this movie, is the children with the jump rope and the, you know, and so that's a very like suburban image right there. It's like, you know, these are kids that look like they're from like a, you know, Catholic school, and they're just like, you know, doing like a little outside recess activity.
Yeah.
But meanwhile, there's this creepy, sinister guy that essentially, you know, molests them and kills them. So it's like, you know, there's this dark horror that's hidden in the suburban life. And it's interesting, right? Because like in the Freddy dreams, you brought up this really great point where he's striking at places where everyone goes to, right? Like everyone's at school and everyone, you know, they're in their regular suburban houses. But then he brings you to this like labyrinth of a boiler room. And that's like his domain, you know? And I think that it's this interesting thing because for a little kid, because the idea is that Freddy would bring kids to like the boiler room, his little area, and like molest them and then eventually kill them. That would be like an endless nightmarish labyrinth to be in that place with this man, you know? Right. So it's fucking dark and twisted. I mean, if you consider the movies that Wes Craven made leading up to this, you know, The Hills Have Eyes, Last House on the Left. I think he did something else called like Deadly Persuasion or something. Deadly Friend is after. There's some other one like Sinister Persuasion or something he did before this. But I mean, for such a guy with such a religious background, who wasn't even into making movies till he's 30, he really makes some like fucked up things. Right? Yeah.
You know, it's funny, as you're talking, you know, there's this idea that you know, the underbelly of a culture, like the underbelly of their little suburbia, is what happened. And pair that with, or compare that to, that a boiler room is literally the underbelly of an industrial space. Right. Like when kids go to school, you know, the school is heated in the wintertime. They never think about how the school is heated. Right.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, it's funny. My dad used to work in schools, and he worked in like a boiler room like that. It wasn't coal, it was oil. But like, I remember going to work with him as a little kid on like a Saturday, which was already weird because it's an empty school. And like his job was like to, and he'd be like, yeah, you have to go in even on Saturdays because it's such a big system. You can't, the pipes will get frozen. Like you have to put it on every day. And, the fire and the heat and the sound, like I still remember it, like these big boilers I experienced that, and it is fucking frightening.
Yes.
You know, think about it. It's like, I mean, if you were to take any child to a room like that and go, this is how the heat works, and it's just scary inferno, they would cry.
yes. It's funny, right? Because one of Wes Craven's movies that he makes after this movie, pretty soon after this movie too, is the fucking Serpent and the Rainbow, right?
Yes, which is, I think, one of my favorite non-scream, non-nightmare. I think that could have been a series like Indiana Jones. Like, I really like Bill Pullman in that.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But what's interesting about that movie and in this discussion is that, like, a lot of it is in another country and everything seems so foreign and weird and stuff to Bill Pullman.
Yeah.
And it just seems kind of barbaric in some ways. And then, like, he kind of brings it back, you know, our
the
world.
First world. Suburb,
you know, there's this creepy stuff that happens when he brings it back with him. This sort of like this curse, this spirit.
Yeah.
Freddie is born in suburbia. He's born in white bread America. He's not from another planet. He's not
from,
you know, another country, some kind of weird, you know, other world. He's from here. He just, you know, takes over dreams because of what happened to him.
Yeah.
So I just want to make it one point too, that the movie I was referring to came out in 1981. It's called Deadly Blessing. I've never seen that one.
I've never seen that either.
Yeah. He made a little TV side movies. Note. Yeah. Well, he made Swamp Thing too in 1982.
Yes, I always forget that.
So Swamp Thing. So basically, he did Last House on the Left in 1972. Then The Hills Have Eyes, Deadly Blessing, and then Swamp Thing, and then this.
Interesting. Wow. Swamp Thing before this.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's crazy, right?
Yeah. But you know, I mean, you could extend. You know, I don't want to sound like some freshman kid in a film class, but you could extend this to anything, right? Like it could be, you know, what we did to the Native Americans. It could be slavery. It could be systematic injustice. Basically, Freddy could be a metaphor for any of these awful things that we pretend aren't there, that we pretend weren't part of our history.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like you see things like this even more like directly, like in things like Poltergeist, right?
Mm-hmm.
Poltergeist, you know, like literally there's like an Indian burial ground and they just removed the headstones.
Right.
Like, well, you know, like, yeah.
Well, do you think that the parents, like, it's wrong that they did vigilante justice to Freddy, or like, is that the reason why the kids are paying the price?
I do. Not that I think, you know, not that I don't think child molestation and murder is the worst thing, but I think it's a miscarriage of law and order. Like, somehow, well, actually, they say, like, just because somebody didn't sign a search warrant, Freddy got off on a technicality, which is crazy.
Mm.
But the idea of my headcanon is that I see this as a sequel to the German expressionist film M by Fritz Lang. Have you ever seen M?
It's an old
German movie. It stars Peter Lorre, who you know, might know from Casablanca, or Bugs Bunny. We do impressions of him a lot.
Yes.
And he basically M is a it's kind of a thriller. He's a child molester that's like terrorizing this town. And actually, you don't see him for most of the movie. He's represented by a whistle that he does. And in the end, there's like no justice. So all of the parents in the town, basically they Freddy him. They burn him to death. They catch him and they burn him to death. And I was like, that's the perfect prequel to this.
Wow. I love that you used Freddy as a verb. They Freddied him.
Yeah.
Awesome.
When you take somebody and you burn them hide the clothes in your own basement or whatever.
yeah. It was a little elaborate. Yeah. Well, let me ask you this, because I mean, obviously you're a film guy and you've like done some research and you know, like, you know what you're talking about. Have you ever read those books? I believe Skull is the author, where he writes like all these books on monsters and horror movies. I think he did a book called Welcome to the Horror Show, and he did another book called Screams of Reason. Have you ever read any of those books?
I have.
Okay. I want to make sure I got the right name and everything, but I'm pretty sure his name is Skull, Skaal. And he did a book that was essentially about like horror, just from like when they had the plays, the stage plays of like Dracula and Frankenstein, all the way up to the slashers and all that kind of stuff too. And he made some really great points about slashers and suburbia, just like you did. And then there's one other book where I can't think of the fucking author's name, but I really got to give them credit. I believe it's a woman. And the book is about like sexuality and slashers and
Men, Women, and Chainsaws by Carol J. Clover. She's the person who coined Final Girl.
Okay. So with that being said, I think if you look at the works of these two authors, they kind of talk about how slashers and horror in general is like you're trying to show that society itself is like diseased or there's something wrong with society, and the slashers are kind of like the product of it, right? And so I think that with like Freddy, even though he's doing this like evil thing and the parents kill this evil being, I think that the dark theme, the thing that's behind it that Wes Craven's probably trying to like get out in his writing, is the idea that like Freddy, just as the molester and the killer, is a product of American suburban culture. Like he's this is like what our culture makes. It makes something like this, and that like you could try to fix it, but if you don't fix it the right way, it actually becomes something even worse, where now he's a fucking boogeyman in nightmares,
you know? There's no repressing it. Because it will come back.
You can't respond to his violence with violence.
Right.
Ultimately, and here's the thing, right, is that I know that Bob Shea, the guy that, you know, backed it, the producer, he wanted to have that ending where he wanted to have Freddy driving that car that they got at the end, right? And I think that Wes Craven's initial ending was actually like a happy ending that didn't have that sort of that stinger.
He didn't want to do any more of them. He wanted to do just one.
Right. And so I think that, like, you know, Wes Craven's idea, if you look at it, if you look at the end of the movie, the way that she ultimately defeats Freddy is she, like, doesn't believe in him. She just says, "You're just a dream." And then he, like, fades as he's trying to attack her. I think that that's kind of like, that's like the passive response to his evil, instead of having a violent response to his evil, where you're, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, because it's not like turning away and pretending it's not there. She acknowledges him, but she doesn't give him any like power. She says, like, "I'm taking away all the power
that
I gave you."
And see, Mike, you and I are recording, which means that we have to mention The Last Jedi.
Sure, yes.
Because every time we fucking record something, we have to mention The Last Jedi.
Yes.
I don't know how we're talking about Nightmare on Elm Street, but that's a big thing about Luke that people don't seem to pick up on Luke Skywalker, which is that in his victories that he has, he chooses not to fight. He chooses not to do something.
Right.
And that's how he wins. That's how he wins in Return of the Jedi. That's how he wins in The Last Jedi.
Yeah.
And that's the way this movie ends. It's not like she like shoots a gun and Freddy blows up or something. You know, she chooses
It's true. And you know, as the series went on, they would come up with different ways to defeat Freddy, and none of them are better than this. This is the best way to defeat him.
Exactly. It's very similar. It's very similar to did you ever watch the Merlin miniseries with like Sam?
Yes, I did.
That's how they fucking get rid of Queen Mab.
Yes.
Spoilers.
For this, like, 30 for a miniseries from like 1996 or something.
From NBC, yes.
Sam Neill.
Yes.
I had the script of it. I bought the VHS and it came with a commemorative script. I was so into that show.
Hey, dude, if you ever want to do a PCMC episode on that, I'm there.
This is why in high school I was just getting laid left and right.
Oh, like, I know.
Did I see Merlin last night?
Yep. I remember when I met you in college, I was like, oh man, that guy, he gets all the ladies because of his Merlin knowledge.
Yeah.
dude, I think we've gone like, what, like 30 minutes or more in this discussion. We haven't mentioned Robert Englund.
We should. He's an incredible actor. I do like what he's doing here more than what comes later, but that's the writing and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's great. I mean, and this was like his first real big thing, right? He had done like little things. I think he had done what's that movie?
He did V. That was like his big thing before this. Yeah, yes. Did you ever see V?
No, I never have.
Yeah, well, so, you know, we're talking about our childhood and like stuff scaring the shit out of us. V was very scary. You know, it came out maybe like a year or two before this, and the imagery from that still kind of haunts me. You know, this idea of like these visitors coming from another planet, and they pretend to be these sort of noble human looking creatures, but they're actually like lizard people underneath, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's so many images of like them getting their masks ripped off, and you see their lizard faces. Robert Englund was one of the lizard people, but he was a good one that was trying to help humans.
Okay. He's, and this is not, I mean no offense, but yeah. He's an odd looking fellow. And sure. I think that helps a little bit. You know, like even, what's the other movie I'm thinking of? Is it Dead something? Like it begins with like photography. What the fuck is it? Dead.
Well, it's a Robert Englund movie.
Robert Englund's in it, but it's not like he's not like the main guy, but he's one of the people in it.
I'll look it up. You know, as we're talking about this, Danny and I actually did a review of this RoboCop documentary called RoboDoc.
Uh-huh.
And it was like fucking fantastic. It was 4 hours talking about RoboCop. And it's by these
Dead
guys.
Buried, by the way, Dead and Buried from 1981.
Okay. Yeah. What I was going to say was that these guys, they did this RoboCop documentary. They've done one on the It miniseries that we watched when we were kids, right? Yeah. And they just do these documentaries on like things from the 90s and the 80s. They did a whole documentary on the filmography of Robert Englund.
Wow.
Yeah. And I want to check it out too. So they probably mentioned that movie. So what's up with that movie? Why were you mentioning it?
It's a horror movie that I'm not sure when he did it. It was in Dead and Buried. 1981. So he did do it before A Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah.
It's a good movie. But that's the thing. He plays like I don't know if he speaks in it. He plays like a town weirdo. Okay. Because he's got an odd look to him. I mean, again, like people talk about like Freddy or Jason. It's like Jason was played by a lot of different people. Kane Hodder tries to act like he's the best Jason, but like he was only in the last couple, you know.
Yeah.
Robert Englund is Freddy. I mean, Robert Englund and Freddy is like, you know, like one of these things like Bela Lugosi and Dracula or Gene Wilder and Willy Wonka. Like the actor and the part are the same.
Right. Synonymous. Yeah. Totally agree. And I mean, when I was watching that documentary, they obviously went through the whole course of the making of the movie. And so they eventually get to the part where Robert Englund comes on set, or not when he comes on set, but when he gets like interviewed for the part and stuff. And it just felt so magical, like when he was coming on, because it was like, oh, then this guy, he had had theater experience, and then he had done a couple of other movies, and then V. But then when he comes into this, they just knew he was right for the part. He was saying that like his friend brought him to the audition, and his friend was smoking. He took his the ashes from his friend's cigarette and like gave himself a, you know, some eyeliner underneath his eyes. And he just kind of stared at Wes Craven like intently. And Wes Craven's like, oh, this guy's got something. So I think he's just something else in this role. Like you said, when they had the glove, there was all different versions of the glove. There was like, you know, a glove with like fake knives, and there was glove with real knives. And he said the very first thing that he did is what a lot of people in the movie did, was he accidentally cut himself with it when he first put it on.
Interesting.
Yeah. And he said that like over time, like when they would have like lunch and stuff, he would still be in the costume and he would kind of fuck around with the knives on his fingers. And once he started kind of playing around with it and putting things on the knives, then he got used to it. And like that glove is just as iconic as his sweater and his look, you know?
I mean, we haven't really talked too much about that too, but what a crazy unique, I mean, weapon. I mean, that alone is such a high concept idea. If you just did a boring slasher movie where the guy just has a knife glove, you'd be like, okay, that's still interesting.
Yes.
Like, It's wild. I think Wes Craven has talked about how like hands or you know, like hands holding hands is an image of friendship and togetherness. And so the idea of like the hand being the thing that hurts you.
Yeah.
And also it's like a cool, it makes him like an animal.
Yeah. It's like feral. He had a cat at the time when he was making this movie, and that kind of inspired him. He saw the cat scratching at something. He's like, oh, that's what we'll do. Yeah. That, that, the glove is like in all of the posters for all the movies. It's on this movie. It's like right over Nancy's head, that iconic poster for the movie.
Scene where she's in the bathtub, which is another scene where we're not in the dream, we're outside the dream. She's not even aware of what's happening. That is all for us, the audience, to be scared.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. It's a very Hitchcock kind of thing, right? Because Hitchcock is like, if the audience is aware of the danger, but the main character isn't, right? That scene, that's like another great example of just like iconic imagery, a scene that like stands the test of time. You know, this movie came out 1984. So what is that? That's like almost 40 years ago now at this point.
Jesus.
Yeah, we're old, right?
This is just one little note I took.
Sure.
Johnny Depp's in this movie. This is his first film. Do you remember when Johnny Depp was like a real person?
Yeah,
I do. That was like a weird pirate wizard.
Yes.
He's like a normal person in this.
Yeah. Did you didn't watch that Netflix documentary, Depp versus Heard, right?
No.
Yeah. No, I mean, we don't have to go into that, but you're right. He has kind of become this like caricature at this point. He has some movies in the beginning of his career where he is playing like a regular person, and he's real endearing and intense, you know. In this, he plays he's kind of against character in this, right? He's very innocent. And at one point, you know, Tina and her boyfriend are off like having really loud sex in another room, and he's with Nancy, and there's no parents. They could do whatever they want, but he's like, oh, we can't, you know.
Right. He's well, she's like the virginal final girl, right? So he, you know, and that's also reflected in Scream. He comes through the window and stuff like that. Let's talk about Nancy a little bit and final girls. If Laurie Strode is in some ways like the first final girl in this kind of subgenre, I think Nancy's my favorite final girl because she's so active. You know, basically at the end, she home alones Freddy.
Yes. Yes, he does.
And she's such an endearing actor. And even though she's virginal and wears like pink cardigans and like slacks, it doesn't stop her from being smart and tough. Like she's tough on her mom. I love the scene where she's like is confronting her mother for being an alcoholic.
Yeah.
And when the mother puts the bars on the window, she like goes in and yells at her mother. Like, I love how she's like she's such a fighter.
Mm-hmm.
And him and her have such chemistry together, which is honestly something you don't see a lot in types of movies. Like, they have chemistry as villain and protagonist
and final girl. Yeah, well, I mean, it was you and your brother, right, talking about Halloween.
Yeah
Like, you guys were saying how like Laurie Strode doesn't really do much, right? She just is.
She's not in the movie until like the last 15 minutes. She meets Michael in the last 15 minutes.
Yeah So it's funny because she's like the iconic final girl, but I mean, Nancy is much more of like in that role. She kind of meets the criteria a lot more.
She puts it together. She puts the mystery together. Like, when she sees her friends start to die, she's the one who's like, okay, wait, we're all thinking about the same person. And you know, even the kids are like, oh, no, that's not possible. Like, everybody tries to, like, just ignore it, and she won't.
Right. Which is interesting about that, right? Because you keep talking about how everyone keeps comparing it to Jason, and they're like, Freddy or Jason, right? In those movies, you'll have final girls too, but they're not as like active as Nancy or clever. They just sort of survive by coincidence. Whereas like Nancy, you know, like at one point she's like, I can't wake up from a dream. You're like, you know, it's just a dream. And then she like burns herself on a pipe, which makes her wake up.
Yeah. And she comes up with, you know, in a lesser movie, she would go see like an old wise man and he'd go, you have to grab him out of the dream. But she doesn't do that. She figures it out herself because she takes his hat. Right. So she really comes up with everything.
Yeah.
And maybe it's because she's fucking alone. Her dad, his parents are divorced. The dad is not seems to be really not in the picture very much, other than when, you know, his daughter's mixed up in a murder.
Yeah.
Mom is this crazy lush. So she's probably used to raising herself.
Yes.
And that's why she's so tenacious.
Yeah, yeah. She asks her dad to help out at the end. She's like, I'm going to go to sleep. I'm going to get this guy. You have to come here at this time to get him, to shoot him or whatever. And it's so funny that that sequence actually kind of made me laugh watching it again, because like he's investigating Johnny Depp's murder right next door.
Right.
And then she's just screaming from the house across the street saying like, Dad, come save me. He's in the house.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's this one stupid fucking cop who's on his team that's like, oh, maybe I should get the chief.
You know,
he's
just
standing there. And then
that guy is the sheriff in Scream. That actor.
Oh, look at that. Okay. Wow. Small world. But I was going to say that, like, you know, the dad comes over. This part was really weird to me. I was kind of wanting to get your opinion on it. He comes over and Freddie is burning the mother alive in the bed.
Yeah.
And then he like knocks Freddie over, and then the mom just kind of fades into the bed. She like gets her burned corpse gets absorbed, you know, into the bed.
Yeah.
And then Nancy basically tells the dad, just give me a minute. I'll be okay. And then he just walks away.
Yeah. It's weird.
Like, isn't it weird? Like,
I think you can extend the metaphor of their blinders being on. Like, even like, I mean, literally, you were just investigating Johnny Depp's murder. How does the blood get on the fucking ceiling? Like, it's impossible. This is magic. But I think it's like, you can't fathom, like, not only is this thing that, you know, you buried coming back, like, you know, you're living in a world where there's magic like this. It's like he wants to, you know, it's continuing to be like, no, this isn't really happening.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is like, again, you can be like, this is a metaphor for racism, sexism, any of the things class injustice, a lot of the things that we pretend aren't really there.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good point. I mean, he sees this fucking charred corpse of an ex-wife just like descending into this blue haze. And it's like, okay, I'll go outside. Yeah. You know,
it's a great image too. It's so weird.
Yeah. Yeah. It must be something from like Carpenter, really, you know?
Yeah. Speaking of Carpenter, he said something so stupid the other day.
Uh-oh.
He said something like, I saw the Barbie movie and it went right over my head. I have no idea what it was. And it's like, shut up, Boomer, you fucking idiot. Like, I do love John Carpenter, but what a stupid... Don't say anything about the Barbie movie. Like, no one needs your take on the Barbie movie.
Yeah.
Dummy.
You know, it's funny, because the reason why Danny's not here, we were going to have Danny be on the show too, is that he's at New York Comic Con right now.
Yeah.
And Danny actually just sent me before I got on here with you a picture of John Carpenter, because he's in a panel right now watching him talk.
Awesome. I had tickets to see him talk a few years ago, but he like got sick and everything was refunded. He's an interesting guy. Although I think Wes Craven is superior. Now I do think that like The Thing is an incredible movie. I think Thing is better than Halloween. I think that's his best movie. But I think Wes Craven's just clearly like an intellectual. Like he's like the Edgar Allan Poe of slasher directors.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's got things that he's really thinking about. And then the worst is like Sean Cunningham. He's just like a carnival barker.
Yeah.
He's like, let's have him jump out of the boat. That'll be scary, right?
Yeah, you gotta have a stinger at the end of Carrie.
Right, exactly the end of Carrie.
Yeah, yeah. No, I know, like Wes Craven is this like soft spoken, intelligent guy.
So before we wrap up, since we're sort of wrapping up this whole month-long Halloween journey into slashers, mm-hmm. what are your favorite slashers? When you think of slashers, like what for you like comes to mind?
Yeah, thanks for asking. That's kind of a fun question to answer. Like I said, Scream is probably my favorite slasher. Yeah. Like out of all of them, right? I love the original Scream. I love the franchise. Mm-hmm. I love. There's a French movie called High Tension or Haute Tension, right? That's a slasher movie too. Yeah. And that's really suspenseful. I love that one.
I've never seen it.
I love the original Halloween, and I went back and watched all the Halloween movies like with you. You know, we actually did the Rob Zombie Halloween movies, right? I love Michael Myers, but you know, I really just like the first one. I even kind of like the David Gordon Green one a little bit. I know
really?
That
Wow.
might be a little bit of blasphemy right now, but it's
doing great right now in his career.
Yes. But yeah, it screamed for me. I used to love Jason. I used to think that Jason was the best out of all of them, but I don't know. I don't really want to rewatch those movies anymore for some reason.
I did a rewatch of all the Jason movies a couple years ago, and I was pleasantly surprised. Like, they don't stand up in comparison to all these other things, but they're fun. Jason movies are like really fun, kind of like fun houses. You know, they're like candy. They're not a steak dinner. You know what I mean? Like, there's nothing nutritious there.
Right.
But it, you know, it's like, if you want like a slasher where it's like, I'm going to see cool deaths, I'm going to see pretty girls without their clothes on, like all of those things. You get that from that series. There's also like no huge peaks and huge lows. It kind of just is in the middle the whole time.
Agreed. Do you like I Know What You Did Last Summer, or you don't?
That's such a good question. When I was super into Scream, I loved it because it was like, it came out before Scream 2 and it was written by the same writer. So it was like, oh, well, this is more of that. So I was like obsessed with it at the time. I haven't gone back and looked at it really in a long time. So it's hard to really say how I feel now, but I was obsessed with it at the time.
Oh, okay. Wow. What do you think makes a good slasher?
A good slasher film or like a good slasher villain?
I don't know. I mean, I guess, like, is that synonymous? Like, do you have to have a good slasher villain to make a good slasher?
I don't know if that's... No, I don't think that's true. What makes a good slasher? I really think... and maybe I'm just going too much by the book, but I really think it helps if it's... If you go by the Halloween, you know, thing of... It's about the return of the repressed, the Freudian thing of the return of the repressed, right? Something tragic happened in the past that we're all trying to forget about and move on from. And, basically, I guess what I'm saying is it has to be more than just cool kills. It has to have a story, and it should have characters you care about. It shouldn't just be, I mean, the worst slasher movies are when they introduce like five characters and they have nothing, like, oh, you're the funny guy, you're the one who likes to cook or whatever, you're the pocket. Yeah. And it's like, there's nothing to them. You're just waiting for them to die.
Right.
So good slashers, like, you know, like, look at the characters in Scream. Like, all of the, even the killers, like, all of the characters are interesting. Yep. They're real characters.
Yep. That's exactly the point I was going to make, is that I think that the characters in the slasher are the most important part. And, you know, it's during that time, like, in our youth, like, it was like Kevin Williamson made a few of these, you know, he made Scream, he made I Know What You Did Last Summer. And
Halloween H2O.
Right. And he would make this great dialogue. He would write this great dialogue for these characters, and they were all believable and they were all clever. And they pointed out what they knew about slashers to begin with. Right. And Nancy's so great in this. I couldn't tell you first name, like, characters, first names from any of the Friday the 13th movies.
No, right. And I just literally watched the first one, and I can't remember. Alice is her name. But like, two, three, four, five, I don't remember. I can't even think of them.
You just kind of refer to them as the actor's name. Like, oh, that's the Corey Feldman. That's
right.
Fucking dad from Back to the Future. What's his
name? Yeah.
Chris. Thank you. Yes. Yeah. And, you know, Mike, you haven't pointed out that we're recording this on Friday the 13th.
Yes, this is Friday the 13th that we are recording this. It just worked out this way. But when you're listening to this, it will be the 25th of October.
Oh, nice.
And this week, but in real time, where you and I are, the Friday the 13th episode came out this week. Which was I gotta say, looking back at this month-long experiment, I liked I think it was good. I could have done so much more. I could have started with a psycho episode, but I didn't. You know, I said I've only got four episodes, and that's, you know, you have a horror podcast. I just have 4 years to sort of like be like, this is our Halloween. And try to make it thematic. And it was fun getting to go back and look at all of these things, especially like their original texts, because they all become different. They all become different. I mean, especially Friday 13th, because it's the first one is not, first one's a whodunit, like Scream. It's not Jason. It's who is it?
Right.
Yeah. Have you ever seen Sleepaway Camp?
I have not. I know how it ends, and I think I've watched like the dead meat of it, where it's like they go the kill count, where they just talk about the kills. But I've not seen it. No.
What about Pieces? Ever see Pieces?
I have not seen Pieces. No.
There's. It's funny. Like we talk about like these major ones, but there's a ton. Silent Night, Deadly Night. You've seen that?
Yes, I have seen that.
Yeah, that's a
Black Christmas.
Yeah. There's right? The Prom Night. There's so many. This was like a big, huge thing. And what's interesting is like, it was such a conservative time in America, right? You had Ronald Reagan as the president. And then even outside of America, in the UK, you had Margaret Thatcher. So you had like this very conservative values. And you have these slasher movies, but these slasher movies themselves, a lot of them have conservative values because they're saying like, if you have sex, something bad will happen to you.
Yes. That's it. Yeah. They are morality tales in themselves. You know?
Yeah. Well, Peter, thank you so much for being here. Tell the listeners where they can listen to more of your content.
Yeah, of course. So like Mike has said a couple of times, I have a show called The Lassercast, and it is on YouTube. You can look it up, The Lassercast, on there, LASSER. And we also have a podcast, too, that you can find on Spotify, all your different podcast providers. We made hundreds of episodes at this point, me and Danny.
Wow.
And this month we are covering Fall of the House of Usher TV show by Mike Flanagan. And we are also covering like basically all these movies that are in the theater right now. Danny just sees them and reviews them. We're actually meeting up with your good friend, David Weiner, on Monday. We're going to be talking about In Search of Darkness, 1990 to 1994, which is his next documentary. Yeah.
Okay, very cool. Yeah.
And besides that, I have one other channel too, which is called Comic Books Transformed, where I talk about comic book adaptations with my friend Brian. And you can look that up on YouTube, Comic Books Transformed. There's also a podcast too. And we just basically talk about comic books that have been adapted into streaming shows and movies. So it's a lot of fun.
Awesome. I want to thank the listeners for listening to these Halloween episodes. We love Halloween, and literally we work on it all year long. I'm thinking about Halloween ideas. I want to thank my guest, Peter, Last Voyage of the Demeter.
Thank you. We end
the episode by saying,
go bye-bye.